This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello there, happy Friday afternoon. Good to have you along today. Before the news headlines at 12:30, taking a look at artificial intelligence and automation in the mining industry. It's already having a huge impact, not only in the field with the big machinery and the big trucks, but also in the office, analysing all the data. So we'll see what's next for the industry shortly. And you'll also meet Anne Cockrum, who's going to tell you how she fell in love with an ancient breed of cattle renowned for their size. They're called Kiania.
The signature thing about them is that they are big, white cattle. They're an Italian breed that's got a very long history. They have black eyeliner eyes. They have a little black switch on their tail and black hooves. And the thing about them is that although they're a very big animal, they're elegant. So to my eyes, they're actually very beautiful. Maybe not to everybody else, but to my eyes, they are very beautiful.
More about the Kiania later this hour, 12:06, here on the Country Hour. Well, the wool market has surged again this week, with the benchmark Eastern Market Indicator up 109 cents a kilo clean to close at 1,453 cents a kilo clean. Its highest level in more than 3 years. Now, breaking that down into a bale of wool, a 17-micron bale of merino wool was selling this week for $2,685. That's up $580 since the 1st of July. And 19 and 21-micron bales of merino wool are worth the highest they've been in the last 5 years. Peter Morris owns PJ Morris, a family-owned wool exporting company based in Fremantle, supplying greasy and scoured wool to China, India, Thailand, Japan, and countries within the EU. Peter, what's driving this wool market?
I think with what's happened over the last 6 to 8 months, politically in America, there's been the issue with tariffs and what impact it's got with our clients. So overall, top making clients, spinners and weavers, have all been very cautious on purchasing wool because they don't really know what the impact's going to be. And I think what's happened is it's settled down now and people have got a little bit more confidence. There's a tiny bit more demand. And so it's created a situation where people have to restock and put wool back into the pipeline.
What sort of message does this send to wool growers then who are seeing what is going on with the prices that we've seen over the last, well, it's been on a run for what, 8 weeks or so now?
Yep, they should be really happy. I just think that the people that are in the industry that have still got sheep and growing merino wool are going to be the benefactors of what's going on at the moment. You know, there's a lack of supply. Demand is reasonable, and I just see better times ahead for them all.
How sustainable are the prices that we're seeing at the moment?
Well, if you look at averages and you look in US dollar terms, which is where our biggest market buys their wool, we're still $1 to $2 US below what's been a level where they've been able to purchase on a regular basis over the years. So they have to have better conditions economically themselves. The Chinese have been very, cautious on purchasing for their own domestic use because, their stock market's been down. There's been a recovery in the stock market. Property prices have kept falling, but that's starting to slow down a little bit. People are cautious spending, but I just think the worst is over.
So there's still quite a lot of upside, you think, in those prices?
I think with upside, of course, there's fluctuations and you're going to have a retracement. You can't just have a market that keeps going up. So don't be surprised if you see a 50 cent or a dollar drop sometimes, but that will recover. And I think over time that the conditions will be good. And there's a real benefit there for wool growers.
What about the overseas mills and China being our biggest market? How are they working through this, absorbing these sort of increases that we've been seeing lately?
There'll be a bit of a shock from some of them. Some of them will have a stock position and will be able to absorb it and actually to sell their products and to take an average. There'll be some other mills that might, as I said, have been short of product, and that will be a bit of a hit for them, and they'll have to readjust and reassess what they're doing. And it might be a case of the bigger ones and the stronger ones are the ones in a better position or in a bit of a better market situation, and maybe there'll be a few of the mills that just might go by the wayside.
Peter, great to get your thoughts. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much, and let's hope for better conditions to continue.
Peter Morris, who owns PJ Morris, it's a family-owned wool exporting company based in Fremantle, just talking about the surge in wool prices this week. The Eastern Market Indicator up 109 cents to close at 1,453 cents a kilogram clean. And here in the West, the Western Market Indicator up 97 cents to close at 1,577 cents a kilo clean. Of course, Danny Burkett along just before the news at 1. He'll go into that market in a lot more detail for you. 11 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Great Southern Shire councillors are pleased with the outcome of a meeting held yesterday with the Agriculture Minister to discuss safety issues related to wandering untagged livestock on local roads. Representatives from the Kojonup and Katanning Shires met with Jackie Jarvis to discuss the long-running issue that they believe is associated with one particular farm in the region. Katanning Shire President Christy DePrill is confident the problem will finally be addressed.
This has been going on for so long, and we really used today's meeting with the Minister to reiterate that issue. And thanks to some media coverage today, she was well aware of what the issue was, and I feel like we have a commitment from her to respond with some action in the very short future.
Okay, so what sort of action have you asked for, and what's your expectation?
The action that we need is an inspection by DPIRD to identify the issues with that landholder and their property identification regulations. We've asked for that. That is, once we have some identification on those cattle, then we can proceed with prosecution of that property owner. Until we have identification, our hands are tied. So that was the clear message that we needed today. We need DPIRD to carry out an inspection of that property ASAP.
And is it a wider problem than that, or will that fix it, do you believe?
Oh, look, no, it won't fix it. That will deal with the immediate risk. As you heard earlier from Katrina, and I have been hearing from our local school bus driver on a very regular occurrence, our children are at risk. There's a school bus that goes past this property every day, and very, very regularly there's wandering cattle, and my gravest concern is that one day that school bus is going to collide with those cattle. So that is why we are urging this immediate action so that we can, you know, reduce the risk to our kids on the school bus. What we need to do after that is more of a long-term strategy.
Okay. And what's your expectation of the timeframe here? Are we talking days? Action?
It has to be days. And we had a commitment from the Minister for Agriculture today that they were preparing for imminent action.
Katanning Shire President Christy DePrill speaking to Andrew Collins on yesterday's Regional Drive show, just after Christy had stepped out of a meeting with the State Agriculture Minister, Jackie Jarvis. Also in attendance at that meeting was her CEO, Peter Klein, and Kojonup Shire President, Roger Bilney. And they're all calling for immediate action, including stiffer penalties and changes to the Local Government Act to allow shires to force landholders to manage livestock responsibly and have appropriate fences. 14 past 12.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio, WA.
A new report shows in Western Australia there are more than twice as many job opportunities upcoming gold projects compared to iron ore, which is quite unusual. The report by the Australian Resources and Energy Employer Association, or AREA, looks at the number of mining projects that are in the works over the next 5 years for each different commodity. And it also looks at how many jobs those projects will create. Tom Reed is Area's Industry Director and the lead analyst for this report. He says WA will need thousands of new workers over the next 5 years for a range of different projects, which sounds impressive, but is actually the lowest on record.
Our report shows that Western Australia's resources and energy industry will require almost 9,000 new workers by the end of 2030. That will be driven from 42 major projects, so mining and energy projects in the pipeline, and those projects will be valued at about $82 billion, so quite a healthy pipeline for WA looking forward.
So just for some context, I suppose, how does that compare to previous years? Is 9,000 a lot?
It does seem like a lot, but it's actually a bit more moderate or a bit lower than what we've previously forecast. So of the 6 years that we've been doing these reports, 9,000 workers in WA's forward-looking five-year pipeline is actually the lowest number of workers that we have forecast, but it's not the lowest number by that many. Last year, for example, we predicted that the future five-year period would require about 11,000 jobs in WA. So it's a couple of thousand down from normal. Not panic stations just yet, but it does send a few signals that we need to be careful about nurturing that investment pipeline.
So let's go through some of the details. If we sort of look at each different commodity, which one stands out to you the most, I suppose?
Well, gold is a real star performer. So we're looking at 11 gold projects over the next 5 years that should create about 2,400 job opportunities. And just for clarity, we are talking about production-associated jobs. So after these mines or energy projects are built, the long-term skills and jobs are required to keep these things operating. So gold is strong. Iron ore has dropped down in terms of the number of projects. There's only four in this year's report, but that still will require about 1,200 workers to come into the iron ore sector over the next 5 years. That drop in iron ore is a big factor in the WA forecast being lower this year than previous years. And then you've got LNG. So we've got seven LNG projects in the five-year pipeline that should create about 1,800 jobs. Quite a mix of minerals and energy sector opportunities in WA. Critical minerals are still strong. Copper is still strong. Lithium has dropped off out of this report. It's dropped right down. So a bit of a mixed bag, but a good diversity of commodities across the board.
So you mentioned that drop in the iron ore projects. Does that tell us that WA is in a mining downturn in that sense?
Not necessarily. It's come off a very pretty strong high over the past 5 to 6 years, iron ore. We've had a really strong surge in new projects. We would like to see more than four iron ore projects in the pipeline over the next 5 years. And in fact, there are obviously more prospective developments and unexplored sort of areas that could be developed. Area just looks at those projects that we consider pretty certain to go ahead. So it's not really a downturn in WA, but just a little bit of a shot across the bow, a warning signal that we need to look at things like regulatory red tape, approvals, processes, even Commonwealth laws like workplace laws that can just turn some investors off the state or off Australia a little bit.
So the drop in number of projects, do you think that has something to do with approval processes being a bit onerous? Am I understanding that right?
That is something that we are hearing from the investment community, that projects are taking longer in Australia broadly to come online, and then that does have an impact on how fast projects are being developed in the investment pipeline. Again, Western Australia has long been one of the top couple of destinations in the world for mining sector investment, but we can't take that for granted and risk, strangling the golden goose with red tape and approval delays and things of that nature. So again, it's not panic stations just yet. It is still a healthy pipeline, but we think there is room for improvement in the regulatory system that would lead to that number of major projects growing further.
And I want to know, how does the situation in WA compare to the rest of the country?
Well, WA still comprises more than half of the national resource sector workforce, the mining industry workforce. And it historically has always had probably double the number of projects in its pipeline and double the number of required employees compared to the second best jurisdiction, which is, of course, Queensland. So over in Queensland, our report this year shows 17 projects for about 4,400 employees, and that's a pretty good number for Queensland. So even WA, with its lowest number ever in our report series, still more than double what you're seeing in Queensland and certainly other states too.
Tom Reed is ARIA's industry director, and he was speaking to Georgia Hargreaves about the report findings, which shows investment in WA's mining industry is slowing and the commodities being invested in are changing. So he was saying there's only four iron ore projects in the pipeline in the next 5 years, and there's about 11 gold projects in the pipeline over the next 5 years for WA. So what that means is about 2,400 new jobs in gold mining compared to just 1,200 new jobs in iron ore. 21 past 12, sticking with mining, because artificial intelligence and automation is already having a significant impact on Australia's mining industry. In fact, Australia could soon be leading the way on the world stage. That's according to Jason Nitz, who's a mining operations strategist and a teacher on the subject at the University of New South Wales. He says AI and automation makes light work of data analysis in any industry.
The main thing that AI can do for mining and other industries is sort through that data, make inferences and correlations with different data sets a lot quicker than a human, and that's where the impact is going to come.
So could you give some examples of just how it's actually being used? What sort of data are we talking about?
Look, exploration data, you know, exploration or finding ore bodies, it uses a lot of data, a lot of sensor data, a lot of huge data sets that can often be disparate. They don't link in well together, but using AI and a lot of the sub features of AI, it can look through that data and find inferences a lot quicker than a human can. And that's the core to AI, is it's not doing anything smarter than a human. In fact, some would say it's dumber than a human. It's just got the ability and the speed to be able to look at lots of data at once and make inferences. But obviously, those inferences or correlations are all programmed by a human. So there's still a human aspect involved in AI. It's just the speed at which it does things.
Okay, so is it at the point yet where it's replacing humans or certain roles?
Look, not in the mining industry yet. Obviously, you know, you hear on the news about AI replacing maybe voice actors, those sort of things, where it's very hard to tell the difference between a human because it's a very human type role. But in the mining industry, not yet. I haven't heard of humans being replaced by AI. Will it happen? Who knows? The future's happening pretty quickly with AI. So that could very well be something down the track.
And what about automation? Can we talk about that for a moment? In what way are things being automated in mining in Australia, and how does it sort of compare to what's being done overseas?
Look, I think Australia is leading the way in the terms of automated mining. Originally, it was a lot of automated haul trucks on the surface up in the Pilbara. That's where it started in Australia. It's now extended to automated equipment underground as well. Obviously, surface is easier to automate because the main way of automation or navigation for autonomous equipment is high-precision GPS, and for that you need to be on the surface. Technologies over the years have developed that you can now navigate underground without the need for GPS, and it uses other technologies such as LiDAR and radar. So Australia's leading the way, but we are getting caught up, and very soon we'll be overtaken by places like China, particularly with the way their technology is expanding, and we'll start to see Chinese autonomous equipment here in Australia. In fact, I think there's some here already.
Yeah, I do remember reading a story a few months ago now about a fleet of about 100 driverless trucks, I think, on a mine site in China.
Yeah, that's right, and that was quite a feat. Not huge mining haul trucks that we're used to, like the haul trucks up in the Pilbara. These are smaller road-going trucks, but still the technology is the same regardless of the size of the truck. But the fact you've got 100 pieces of equipment running around on a very confined area, because a mine site is reasonably confined, and there is no collisions, they're all doing the job well, that's quite a feat, definitely.
Yeah, and you can understand, I suppose, the pros in terms of safety and potentially saving on wages and that sort of things. But there must be some challenges with that as well.
There is, in terms of the technology integration. It takes a change of mindset of people within the mining company to go from having conventionally driven equipment to now autonomous equipment. It takes quite a mindset, and it takes a different type of people. And thankfully, a lot of the mine sites in Australia that have moved from conventional haulage trucks to autonomous haven't lost a lot of people. It hasn't put a lot of people out of roles. They've had to adapt and adopt and learn new skills and come back in and do something a little bit different. So it hasn't been a case of all these people are now out of a job. They transitioned into other areas.
Jason, I want to know, how long do you think it'll be before the role of being a dump truck driver or a truck driver is null and void?
That's a good question. And look, if you look at where all these autonomous trucks are, they're with your major mining companies, you know, BHP, Rio Tinto, those larger companies that can make the investment. You're still going to have your mid-tier and your small miners who, you know, just can't afford to invest in that type of technology. It's not cheap to invest in it. It does have a longish payback, particularly on the size of your fleet. And you also have to have a fleet size that makes the change economical. And a lot of these smaller mining companies won't. So I think there will still be roles out there for human haul truck operators. They'll probably slowly diminish over the years, but until the technology becomes cheaper for those smaller miners to adopt, I still think there'll be roles for the next 5 to 10 years.
Mining operations strategist Jason Nitz speaking to Georgia Hargreaves. 26 past 12. A few of you keen to jump in on the conversation on the text 0448 922 604, especially on the Great Southern Shire councillors who are pleased with the outcome of a meeting held yesterday with the Ag Minister Jackie Jarvis to talk about safety issues related to wandering untagged livestock on local roads. You heard the Katanning Shire President Christy DePrill saying she's confident after that meeting with the Minister that the problem will finally be addressed. Pete in Narrogin says, glad the Shires are doing something about the straying livestock situation. School buses carry precious cargo. Lloyd says, roaming cattle is a long-term problem. Fines will not get them off the road immediately when the problem is with the owner's management ability. And Peter says, if the Ag Minister allows local government powers to do what is the department's job, then a council should be sending the bill for all costs to the Ag Department, their subcontractors. And Pete also wanted to jump in on the price of wool, which has surged again this week, the Eastern Market Indicator up 109 cents. And Pete says, if some processors are forced out of the market, then farmgate prices will be configured by less competition and possible single desk buyer. Prices might go up, but then become more stable and then manipulated lower. Hopefully supply and demand both rise. The text to be part of the conversation, 0448 922 604, 28 past 12.
The Country Hour, part of your community and your life.
It's nostalgic.
For 80 years.
Hanging out with my brothers in the back of a ute.
The Country Hour.
They just naturally grow a beautiful shape.
Celebrating 80 years of telling rural stories on ABC Radio.
28 past 12 here on The Country Hour, and Jonathan Hopper is in the studio with the news headlines. Hello.
Good afternoon, Belinda. The Health Minister says he's determined to protect Australia's pharmaceutical benefits scheme in the wake of US President Donald Trump's latest tariffs. Mr. Trump has announced a 100% tax on imported pharmaceuticals. Australia's largest pharmaceutical company, CSL, says it does not expect any material impact from the tariffs, and experts say it shouldn't affect the PBS. The AUKUS submarine pact is expected to be top of the agenda at a meeting between the Prime Minister and his British counterpart. Anthony Albanese has arrived in London, where he will meet Sir Keir Starmer at No. 10 Downing Street. And Geelong's Mark Blitzov has welcomed the inclusion of ruck Rhys Stanley into Geelong's side for tomorrow's AFL Grand Final. Defender Tom Stewart, who was earlier ruled out of the game with concussion, makes way in the side for Stanley, who hasn't played since round 24 with a hamstring injury. Thanks, Belinda.
Thank you for the update, Jonathan. It's 29 past 12 here on The Country Hour. Still to come, we'll look at the wool market, which has gone off again this week. Danny Burkett will be along to go through sales here in the west and in the east. And you'll meet Anne Cockrum. She's going to tell you how she fell in love with an ancient breed of cattle renowned for its size. And we'll also catch up with a fisherman and his thoughts in relation to those risks to certain fisheries that was released, a report released by the government last week. First, though, let's make our way to the Bureau of Meteorology, and Bob Tarr is with you this afternoon. Bob, let's take a look around the Southwest Land Division.
Sure. Yeah, we have milder conditions across the region. A cold front passed by to the south and has brought a change in the orientation of the ridge across the region. So still a fair amount of cloud over the Aspen's region, although it's been burning off. And there could be the odd light shower across that area today. And then later on today around the south coast to the west of around Bremer Bay, but very little in the gauge with any of that. Otherwise, we just have those milder conditions, so near to a little bit cooler than normal temperatures for much of the region, aside from northern parts, which are still somewhat warm. And then tonight, beneath that ridge, we'll get a little bit colder, not looking at especially cold temperatures, but in the coldest spots down to about 4 or 5 across the region. No frost expected, though. And then tomorrow, just a slight chance of showers around the south coast, but otherwise pretty sunny skies for much of the region. The next cold front arrives on Sunday. We'd likely to see a little bit more in the ray of rainfall associated with that one, and it will push up a little bit further to the north through Perth, and slight chances of showers up through into the southern part of the Wheat Belt as well as the Great Southern. Again, we're looking at light falls associated with that southern part of the Scarp and along the southwest coast. You could see up to maybe about 5 mils associated with that cold front, but it's a fairly weak one, and then that will contract away to the east on Monday with a new high-pressure ridge developing. A few showers around the Esperance region on Monday, but otherwise mainly dry conditions throughout the region. And then another weak cold front brushes the southwest corner on Tuesday. Less in the way of showers associated with that one. Most of those would be around the southwest corner and the southwest coast. Slight chance that those could push up as far as Perth and into the western parts of the Great Southern, but most of that will be limited to the southwest corner. And then yet another high-pressure ridge builds in behind that, looking at a warming trend behind that one as we get into Thursday and Friday, considerably warmer temperatures. As far as the minimum temperatures, another somewhat cold night on Monday night, Tuesday morning, could be down to as low as maybe 2 or 3 over far eastern parts of the Wheat Belt and out through the inland areas from Esperance. And then again, Thursday morning could be down as cold as about 2 or 3. But we're looking at, if there's any frost, it's going to be very marginal. We're not looking at any hard frost across the region for at least the next week. And any frost that does occur on those couple of nights will be very patchy in nature.
Let's move into northern and eastern parts now, Bob.
Yeah, so in the north, probably the main story is that the winds have really eased considerably. A lot of places like Port Hedland and then out through places like Derby and Fitzroy Crossing, the winds were about 20 kilometers an hour lighter this morning than they were relative to yesterday morning. So that's pretty good news in that there are a number of seasonal bushfires around the Kimberley, and so those lighter winds are expected to continue for the next few days, so that should help crews up there that are doing some work on those bushfires. But yeah, all in all, looking at a fairly settled pattern over northern areas, maybe slightly more wind developing over western parts of the Pilbara as we go out towards Tuesday and Wednesday, and then also a slight chance of afternoon showers returns to far northern parts of the far northern parts of the Kimberley, and that'll be on the weekend and into early next week. But no significant rainfall associated with those. It'll be very patchy and over quite remote areas. Yeah, otherwise we're looking at pretty typical normal. I'd say build-up conditions. So starting to get kind of warm, but not too oppressive over northern parts of the state.
Thanks so much, Bob. Appreciate that. 26-1, and Richard Hudson in the studio now. Any rain about, Richard?
No, not really. The most was Tamar with 1 mil in the southern coastal region, but even that might just be a bit of an exaggeration on just a tiny bit of dew in the gauge, I reckon.
And your grand final plans, what have you set in action?
Haven't finalised them yet. My eldest daughter is actually keen to watch it with me for once, so that plan is likely to be locked in and then changed last second, so there's every chance I could be watching it on my own. But I'm actually going to be tuning in a bit earlier than most people because the Futures game starts early in the morning, WA time. So this is all representatives born in 2008, but they're eligible for next year's AFL draft. So it's not the ones who are about to get drafted this year. Eight WA boys are playing, including, this is the guy that I chatted to about a year ago, country boy Lucas Robinson, whose family farms in the Lake Grace area. Watched him play in last week's Colts Grand Final. His team, South Freo, lost to Claremont, but he is a player. He's relatively tall for a midfielder. He can take a mark. Played rugby for a year and it shows. He loves to tackle. I sort of describe him as playing like a beast, even though he doesn't have a body of a beast yet. He's still young. But one of the other seven WA players in that match is Kobe Lacroix, who some footy followers might know the family name. And they come from, well, he's played for West Perth and Cervantes. He's the son of former North Melbourne and West Perth player Brent Lacroix. His uncle is Mark, who some people might know from West Coast. But also playing is Benji Van Rooyen. So his brother Jacob, some people who follow AFL know that his brother plays for Melbourne. So if you want to watch that Futures game, it'll be streamed live and free on the AFL website and the AFL Live app, and that starts at 7:35 in the morning, WA time.
Are you auditioning to be a scout?
No, I just love my footy, and I'm having withdrawal symptoms because Frio's out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Richard. 24 to 1 here on the country on the ABC right across Western Australia, streaming live on the web and on the ABC Listen app. A commercial fisher in the state southwest says more funding needs to be invested into fish stock data collection to protect vulnerable species. Now, this follows last week's announcement from the state government that demersal fish stocks, including pink snapper and jewfish along the west coast, are at a severe risk of collapse. Kawarumup-based commercial demersal fisher Vern Wild says the assessment doesn't quite match what he's seeing out on the water.
I kind of expected it, but I don't 100% agree with it. I feel like the science is obviously the science, and that's what we've got, but I feel like it's lacking in areas. Obviously, there's a few things, in my opinion, that could be done better. There's also some data that I feel like is skewed slightly. I do a lot of commercial frame donations to research. As far as the jewfish go, that's probably the main concern. There's a common theme that there's not enough old fish in the stock. The trouble with that for me is I don't process any of the bigger fish because they don't eat as well. So most of the bigger fish I'll send to my markets up in Perth. So we're kind of getting a collection of frames that's slightly skewed as far as the data would go, because, you know, to have a good stock of jewfish, you basically need a good age range across the board. So if you haven't got that good age range, there's risk of the stock collapsing if it's all coming from one or two cohorts of good breeding years.
Mm, so when you say you don't necessarily agree with that assessment, what are you seeing out on the water?
Well, the summer just gone, it's the most jewfish I've ever seen in the southwest. And obviously conditions were good. If the water temp is good and the food is there, they'll turn up in good numbers. And they turn up to breed every year. There's a common misconception that they don't move around, but in my mind, they actually move around a lot more than what people give them credit for.
In October, the state government's hosting a round table with key industry stakeholders to talk about the fish stock concerns. What do you think needs to happen? What would you like to see enforced?
It's kind of a hard one because the data we've just got is already 2 years old. It's a later stock assessment. It takes 3 years to get a stock assessment done. So you're always slightly behind on the data. So I don't feel personally that the stocks are as bad as what the stock assessment's saying. But on the other hand, there's numbers that they need caught and kept under those numbers to be sustainable. The commercial catch has obviously been over in previous years, but on every occasion we've had cuts the very next year, and we're only halfway through our most recent cuts. So we're 9 months into this year, which we've had some pretty substantial cuts again last year. And the catches this year are tracking pretty good. So as far as the round table goes, I think for me, a big one is some sort of better collection of data from the recreational sector. You know, the commercial data is right down to the last 100 grams. Like everything's weighed off every single day, and we know exactly what's been extracted, but you can't manage a fishery if you don't know what's been extracted as a whole. So I feel like the mandatory reporting is, you know, as hard as that is to accept for people that are doing this as a hobby and a pastime, I think it's critical. You know, you can't manage a fishery without knowing what's been extracted. I think it's just as far as the research goes, like us commercial guys do a lot of work with research and donating frames and that sort of thing, but there's a real shortage of funding in DPIRT in the fisheries department. And I think the government really needs to get some more funding there so we can actually get guys out on the boats and see what's happening on the water and whether it's camera work or whatever it may be, but work with the guys that have been doing this a long time. You know, there's a few operators that have been going over 40 years and they've got a wealth of knowledge. It's there to be exploited by the department. They can certainly use it to their advantage to manage things better, but they need the funding to do it. And, yeah, unfortunately, in the last couple of years, the funding's not been there. The research is critical. I think what's been done in the past is obviously not, you know, we're at the point now, it's not working. We need to change our whole way of thinking.
Do you think if further restrictions are introduced, do you expect many businesses will pull out?
Oh, there'd be quite a few. I think it's a breaking point for a lot of guys now.
Have you already seen that happening?
Yeah, definitely. You know, we've got annual management meetings. I mean, we haven't had one for the last couple of years, just not sure why, for whatever reason, the department hasn't been able to organise that, whether it's funding cuts and they don't have the people, I'm not sure. But definitely over the 20-odd years I've been fishing, every meeting you have, there's a couple more guys gone, and it's quite sad to see, really.
Kawarumup commercial fisher Fern Wilds speaking to Amelia Searson, and the state government is hosting a roundtable on October 20 with key stakeholders to discuss the results of these stock assessments and what needs to happen moving forward. 19 to 1. Let's make our way now to Carriedale in the state's southwest, because that's where Georgia Hargreaves found out about a truly remarkable love story.
Love at first sight is something you never forget.
It was at the Royal Show, at the Perth Royal Show.
It's something you have no control over.
I'm a social worker working in Perth, married to somebody else, with two little girls.
Anne Cockrum remembers the exact moment lightning struck for her.
During the Grand Parade, and it was in about 1984, I think, and I was there at the show with my two young daughters at the time. They were majestic. They were majestic to see and to watch them walk.
The object of Anne's affection probably isn't what you're thinking. Anne had fallen in love with one of the oldest and largest breeds of cattle in the world, the Chianina, also known as the Giants of Italy.
They have black eyeliner eyes. The signature thing about them is that they are big white cattle.
It would take a while for Anne to meet someone who shared her love of the giant breed.
I grew up on a farm in New Zealand, and my brother was doing an ag course, and he pointed out, hey, look at these cattle here.
That's Noel. He met Anne years after her first marriage ended, and it turns out they had quite a bit in common.
They're over 2,000-year history. They believe that it's before Roman times to the Etruscan times, so the history is there. You know, you're talking Julius Caesar, Cleopatra, all that sort of history. They've lived through that history.
They're an ancient breed, in my mind, a very noble creature, because they have been associated with humanity for a long, long time.
The now married couple were determined to find a way to get the giant cows to their farm in Carriedale in WA's southwest.
We brought over embryos from Italy, and that was astonishing to me that you could bring like a little live, living being, you know, in a cylinder. Yeah, and then implant it, and then it grew.
As much as they love their girls, cows that big come with their challenges.
In all honesty, I don't manage them. My husband does.
They're so big because I think the Italians over years have selected the biggest animals for the draft. You know, you've got some of the richest, healthiest beef in the world.
But it does make me really emotional, actually, to to me, to my eyes, they're actually very beautiful. Maybe not to everybody else, but to my eyes, they are very beautiful.
Anne Cockrum and her husband Noel speaking to Georgia Hargraves about breeding the biggest cows in the world. The ancient breed is called Chianina, and their genetics come all the way from Italy. So they must be good. That piece from the story stream on the ABC Listen app. And this year's Perth Royal Show kicks off tomorrow. And I wonder, it could be the setting for some more love stories. 12:45.
This week on Landline, fencing farms without fences.
So the cows learn a sound cue, an increasing sound beat, as a warning that they're approaching a virtual boundary.
That's Landline 12:30 Sunday on ABC TV and iView.
Shortly, Danny Burkett will be along. He's going to go through the wool market for you. Is this the 11th week? No, it might be the 10th week of the prices going up. It's been an incredible run anyway. Danny with the details just before the news at 1 o'clock. First though, the star attraction at this week's Henty Machinery Field Days in southern New South Wales was a massive beast of a tractor. Everything about it is big, including the price tag at about $1.5 million, depending on the options. Reporter Annie Brown was at the event where a few farmers were having a look.
It's pretty big and fancy. It's quite good.
Yeah, if I had the money, I would. She'd be a big price tag for a big tractor, but I'd get one if I could.
Big. That's your first thought, but yeah, it's very impressive.
Dubbed the biggest production tractor in the world, the John Deere 9RX830 was on full display. To put it into perspective, the average tractor has a horsepower of around 150 to 200. This tractor has a horsepower of 830.
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing to see how big it is up close. 830 horsepower, that's just insane. From where we've come over the last 50 years, it's revolutionary, really.
Are you going to climb into the cab and have a look from the top?
Oh, I'm in a tractor more than enough. At the farm, so I'm the same. I said, enough time in there, so on a day off, we like to stay away from it.
There were plenty of people circling this beast of a tractor. Kids climbing into the cab, farmers looking under the bonnet. There was plenty of intrigue. But Thomas Dewhurst, a group sales manager at Hutchin & Pierce, said not many people were pulling out the checkbooks at Henty this year.
Significantly bigger than previous models. I know if you're standing next to it, kind of well over 6 feet every track. And huge footprint, and that's required because the tractor, fully ballasted, is 38 tonnes. So
it is a beast.
It is, but it's got to have that weight to get the power to the ground. So,
what would you use a tractor like this for in farming?
A lot of seeding application mostly, and maybe wider tillage application. From efficiency and scale point of view, the wider you go, the more efficient. So we've seen seeding rigs pushing out past 80 feet recently, and the current horsepower that we have is not necessarily always doing the job. So yeah, really great to have another option for farmers that can kind of potentially take them from two machines back to one and kind of increase their efficiencies.
Is bigger better in this case?
In this case, bigger is definitely better.
And a lot of people are probably thinking, listening to this, and I'm sure you've been asked this already a million times, but what's the price tag on a tractor like this?
Oh, I mean, you're probably looking somewhere in the $1.5 million range. But again, completely dependent on options. But when you look at it from a dollars per horsepower point of view, it compares really favourably to all current machines on the market.
Have you sold any at Henty this weekend?
None at Henty, but we've plenty of interest, which has been great. And we do have units in the market already.
In terms of, I guess, machinery sales in general, I mean, this is one of the biggest machinery field days in the country, so people coming to have a look. But what's happening in that space? Are people spending? Are people buying? It's been an incredibly tough year, especially around here in Henty.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting season, especially in our part of the world here. I'd say it's probably a bit quieter year, but there's still a lot of interest. The recent rain has kind of made people interested again, but we just have to see what harvest does. It's really hard to make any decisions without knowing exactly how the crops are going to come off, and that's probably what we're seeing at the moment.
Are sales down?
Not necessarily down. They're probably a little bit quieter right now, but that's not uncommon at this time of year.
Do you find a lot of farmers buy at a field days, or are they coming to have a look and more of a feel of what's on offer?
No, yeah, it's definitely more to come and see what's available, have a look at the new technology. We're really lucky with the tech site set up here. We've got a full technology set up that customers can come and look at.
It's the biggest tractor in the world here at Henty Field Days. It's really cool to come and have a look at it. Can tractors get bigger than this, or do you expect them to get bigger?
Oh, everything can always get bigger, but I think this might be the ceiling for a little bit.
Thomas Dewhurst from farm equipment supplier Hutchin and Pierce. He was speaking to Annie Brown at the Henty Field Days that were on this week in southern New South Wales. 10 minutes to 1. A massive 14-metre-wide mural depicting the history of farming in Western Australia's Great Southern has been unveiled at Newdigate. The mural was painted live during the recent Field Day event by Jacob Butler, who's better known as Shaky.
I'm painting a tribute to the history of Newdigate, and also I'm doing it at the Field Day, so I wanted to create a storyline which kind of shows how the town came to be and also how the Field Days came to be as well.
So explain to us what's in the mural here.
Well, I wanted to go way back in history and start with John Holland and his track to kind of pay tribute to those pioneers and what they went through and the amazing resilience they had. And then the timber cutters that came a little bit later during the 1910, 1915. And then wanted to paint what it was like, I guess, to be in the rural life in the 1920s. So I saw some photos of an old Humpy and a car. And I kind of just wanted to imagine how that would have been like. So the scene I created is just a boy saying g'day to his dad, who's farming in the background. And I got two little girls in a little tub, which happened to be my daughters, because I like to put him in all the paintings. And then I've split the timeline up with the arrival of the train, which gave way for the town. And then you can't forget the sport and how important that is for communities. I wanted to kind of jump to that timeline where it was the footy players who formed their association in the 1950s and just also pay tribute to all the sporting people. And I know it's very contentious that I've got a hockey player there, but the thing is that we're talking about the 50s, so sorry, netballers.
As a hockey player myself, I appreciate that, Jack.
Oh, that's good. I knew this would happen, so I've got netballers, tennis players, golfers and cricketers, which are all very big sports. And then I just wanted to move on to show, pay tribute to women in agriculture and how they play a big role in it as well. And they're also out there driving the harvesters. So it's a lady with her boy, and then looking towards the field days. And the whole point of that scene is showing how the community crop actually helps develop the town, and the crop's going right back into the machinery field days. And also the CWA ladies, that's kind of like the last focal point.
What do you hope this mural will mean for the community?
Oh, I think it's just a great opportunity for them to share their story and also celebrate their community. I'm just so inspired by Newdigate. They're just the loveliest people. I've had the best meals of my life here. Sorry, Mum. But I just hope they treasure it, and I hope it's a chance for them to share their community to a wider audience.
Mural artist Jacob Butler, who paints under the name Shaky. And it's not just the front of the sports pavilion that now proudly displays a mural. Newdigate Field Day committee member Jesse McDonald says the whole community got involved in their farm scale competition.
So that mural competition is inspired by the mural that we're having done by Jacob Butler, and we thought, what an amazing way not just to have an artist in residence for people to immerse themselves in art that way, but also for people to be able to create their own murals too and have something lasting from 2025 that is going to bring nothing but beauty and joy to people's individual farms and spaces and places.
So what have you seen so far from those farms?
We have seen a really significant mix of artworks. No two are the same. We have some textural works. We have some works that are a little bit more abstract. We have larger works, and then we have kind of more fine art style works too.
And would you say that Newdigate and the farming community around the region is quite arty? Where is this inspiration coming from?
I think everyone's got a creative capacity within them, and I think it's just about providing the opportunity to allow people to explore that, especially people who don't often get the opportunity to.
What do you think a competition like this shows you about the farming community?
I think it shows that farming communities are so much more than a stereotype. I think it allows people to demonstrate skills and thoughts and creativity that they don't often get to publicly display, and allows them to explore that avenue within themselves, even though it's not necessarily what is expected.
Jessie McDonald from the Newdigate Field Days Committee speaking to Tara de Landgraft. 5 minutes to 1 o'clock. Well, the wool market is up again this week. The Eastern Market Indicator up 109 cents to finish the week on 1,453 cents a kilogram clean. And the Western Market Indicator up 97 cents to close at 1,577 cents a kilo clean. Danny Burkett, another impressive week.
Yes, and I'll start by quoting the AWEX report for the week. Quote, the weekly rise was the largest in 6 years and extended the rally to 10 straight weeks, equaling the longest unbeaten run weekly since 1987, unquote. So a fantastic result across the board, regardless, Merino, Crossfed, etc., all were very dear for the week. In WA, we had a one-day sale on the Tuesday, 23rd, 17 micron. There was no quote for WA, so I'd suggest they closed around about $20.70 clean, which was plus $2.40 on the market. 18 microns up $1.55 to close at $19 flat. 19s closed at $17.75. That's up $1.45. 20 microns up $0.85 to close at $16.60. 21s hot in their heels up $0.90 to close at $16.35. Pieces and bellies on the fine end, $1.20 clean better. On the medium types, roughly a dollar, regardless of VM length or style. It's interesting, we're now starting to see the price differential between the fleece and pieces start to open up, which is extremely normal when we see a market run like it is. The lagging end of the market, oddments, if you look at stones, crutchings and locks, were only 15 clean dearer. We generally, when we see a wool market move, it is the lower value types that go first, but we are seeing the reverse at the moment. And just on that, if we look at the forward market for wool, which you could argue is a closed market, pretty much we have mills from overseas, overseas traders, and Australian growers forming that market. In the first 2 or 3 weeks of this rally, the forward market followed the physical, but at the moment it has plateaued. It is roughly sitting $1.50 clean behind the fine end and roughly a dollar behind the mediums. So it says to me the exporters are not willing or prepared to put those prices we're seeing in the physical market out into the forward months. So it says to me they may be seeing this as a spike and will roll over very quickly. Time will tell. The issue at the moment and has been and will continue to be is supply. So next week we only have again 35,000 or just above on the wool market between Sydney, Melbourne, Fremantle. That makes Fremantle a one-day sale. So supply issues will remain. I would suggest so when we do see that forward market move, it will move in dollars and catch up to the physical very quickly.
Who was on the list of buyers this week, Danny?
We had Tech Wool, PJ Morris, Endeavour Wool and Sequoia. So Tech Wool taking 20% of the Merino fleece wool across the country. Morris just shy of 17, Endeavour just above 15 and Sequoia just below 11. The big one missing there is TNU. If we look at TNU's buying pattern, they were heavily involved in the market 8 weeks ago and prior and were for probably 2 or 3 years. I would suggest it makes their purchases look very good at the moment. And it's actually a good thing not to see them in the market at the moment, because I'd suggest if this market does come back a touch, we'll have TNU in there to set a floor again, because they'll start to have to buy wool at some stage. Just mentioned Tech Wool Trading, also the largest buyer in the Merino skirtings across the country as well.
And looking forward to next week, was it 35,000 bales you said will be on offer in total next week?
Spot on, Bill, just above. So Sydney, Melbourne, Fremantle, just above 35,000. Again, limited supply of Merino wools. It's Melbourne, probably one quarter of their offering is still related to crossbred types. And just on the crossbred types, they are also enjoying a rally. If we look at medium crosses, 24, 25 micron, they were plus 80. If all the way down to your downs types at 32 micron, they were also plus 80 for the week. So across the board, left, right, north, south, east and west, a very strong wool market. And bodes very well as we head into
details next week.
Danny, thank you for going through those details. The Eastern Market Indicator up 109 cents this week. The Western Indicator up 97 cents. Max on the text says the wool price rise is good news for producers. However, the price is still many dollars a kilo less than we received in 2018. Since then, costs have gone through the roof with fertiliser double the price, along with rising costs of shearing. So let's keep the price rise in perspective and acknowledge producers have not been breaking even over the last few years. Max, thanks so much for that text. Appreciate that. Good to talk to you today on the ABC right across WA. It is news time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.